Chapter 19. "Why is it Dirk gets all the choice projects?" groused Giordino. "I'll bet as we speak he's sleeping in a warm, comfortable cabin on board the Polar Storm with his arms around some gorgeous female marine biologist." He was soaked and shivering under the wind-driven sleet as he stumbled across the rocky slope toward the cave. Carrying an armload of small branches he and Gunn had cut from scattered scrub brush they'd found growing around the mountain. "We'll be warm, too, once the wood dries enough to catch fire," said Gunn. Walking slightly ahead of Giordino, with his arms loaded with straggly branches almost bare of leaves, he thankfully stepped through the archway and into the tunnel. He threw his burden on the rocky floor and collapsed in a sitting position against one wall. "I fear all we're going to do with this stuff is make a lot of smoke," Giordino murmured, removing his dripping foul-weather gear and wiping the water that had dribbled down his neck with a small hand towel. Gunn handed Giordino a cup of the now cold coffee from the thermos and the end of the granola bars. "The Last Supper," he said solemnly. "Did Sandecker give you any idea as to when he can get us off this rock pile?"
"Only that transportation was on the way."
Giordino examined the dial of his watch. "It's been 4 hours. I'd like to make Cape Town before the pubs close." "He must not have been able to charter another tilt-rotor and a pilot, or they'd have been here by now." Giordino tilted his head, listening. He moved through the tunnel until he was standing under the archway. The sleet had fallen off to a light, sprinkling rain. The overcast was breaking up, and patches of blue sky emerged between the swiftly moving clouds. For the first time in several hours, he could see far out to sea. It was there like a fly speck on a frosted window. As he watched, the speck grew into a black helicopter. Another mile closer, and he identified it as a McDonnell Douglas Explorer with a twin tail and no rear rotor. "We have company," he announced. "A helicopter flying in from the northwest, coming fast and low over the water. Looks like he's carrying air-to-ground missiles." Gunn came and stood beside Giordino. "A helicopter doesn't have the range to fly here from Cape Town. It must have come from a ship." "No markings. That's odd." "Definitely not a South African military aircraft," said Gunn. "I do not believe they're bearing gifts," said Giordino sarcastically, "or they would have called and said to expect them." The sound of the helicopter's turbines and rotor blades soon broke the cold air. The pilot was no daredevil, but very cautious. Flying a safe height above the cliffs, he hovered for at least 3 minutes while he studied the ledge that once held the tilt rotor. Then he dropped down slowly, feeling his way through the air currents. The landing skids touched the rocky surface, and the rotor blades slowly spun to a stop. Silence then. Without the wind, the mountain slopes went quiet. After a short time lag, the big 50-inch sliding cabin door opened, and 6 men in black coveralls dropped to the ground. They looked as if they were carrying enough weapons and firepower to invade a small country.
"Strange-looking rescue party," said Giordino.
Gunn was already on his Global Star phone, dialing the Admiral in Washington. When Sandecker responded, Gunn said simply,
"We have armed visitors in an unmarked black helicopter."
"This seems to be my day for putting out brush fires," Sandecker said caustically. "First Pitt, and now you." Then his tone betrayed earnest concern. "How long can you hide out?"
20, maybe 30 minutes, replied Gunn.
"A U.S. missile frigate is sailing at full speed toward St. Paul Island. The minute their helicopter is within range, I'll request the captain to send it aloft."
"Any idea, Admiral, how long that will be?" There was a heavy pause. Then, 2 hours, hopefully less.
I know you tried, said Gunn quietly, a patient understanding in his voice. And we thank you.
He knew the Admiral's hard shell was about to crack.
Not to worry. Al and I will be back in the office by Monday.
See that you do, said Sandecker somberly.
Goodbye, sir.
Goodbye, Rudy. God bless. And tell Al I owe him a cigar.
I will.
How long? Giordino asked, seeing the disquieting expression on Gunn's face and expecting the worst.
2 hours.
Well, that's just peachy, Giordino grunted. I wish someone would explain to me how those murdering slime knew we were here.
Good question. We were part of a select group. No more than 5 of us knew the location where the Madras passengers found the black skull.
I'm beginning to think they have an international army of finks, said Giordino.
The search party split up. 3 of the armed men spread out 50 yards apart and began sweeping their way around the mountain. The other 3 took off in the opposite direction. It looked evident that they were going to spiral their way up the mountain until they found the tunnel.
An hour, murmured Gunn. It will take them the better part of an hour to stumble on the old road.
More like 5 minutes, said Giordino, gesturing toward the helicopter that rose in the air. The pilot will lead his buddies right to our doorstep.
Think it will do any good to parley?
Giordino shook his head. If these guys are tied in with the bunch Dirk and I met in Telluride, they don't shake hands, hug, or give quarter.
2 unarmed men against 6 loaded for bear. We need to even the odds.
Got a plan? Asked Giordino.
I certainly do.
Giordino gave the little man with the academic, nerdy look a bemused stare.
Is it evil, rotten, and sneaky?
Gunn nodded with an impish grin.
All that and more.
The helicopter circled the mountain nearly 4 times before its pilot spotted the ancient road leading to the tunnel. Informing the 2 search teams, one of which was far around the other side of the mountain, he hovered over the road as a guide. The first team of 3 men converged on the road and advanced in a line, a good 20 yards apart. It was a classic penetration pattern. The first man concentrated on the terrain ahead, as the second studied the upper slope of the mountain, while the 3rd trained his concentration on the lower side. The helicopter then moved toward the 2nd team to guide them along the easiest path to the road. The 1st team on the road negotiated the landslides and approached the giant rock Gunn and Giordino had passed earlier, just outside the tunnel entrance. The lead man moved around the rock and found himself standing outside the archway. He turned and shouted to the men behind.
"I've reached a tunnel," he said in English. "I'm going in."
"Be wary of an ambush, number one," the 2nd man in line shouted back.
"If they had weapons, they'd have used them by now."
The leader disappeared around the rock. Then, 2 minutes later, the 2nd man did. Out of sight of the others, the 3rd man in line was approaching the rock, when a figure quietly rose up from the rocks where he had been buried. His concentration trained on reaching the tunnel, the searcher did not notice the soft clunk of loose rock or hear the silent crunch of footsteps at his back. He never knew what hit him, as Gunn swung a large rock with such viciousness it fractured his skull, and he dropped without a sound. Less than a minute later, the body was completely covered and hidden under a pile of rocks. A quick look to ensure that the helicopter was still out of sight on the other side of the mountain, and Gunn was creeping around the rock. This time, though, he was armed with an assault rifle, a 9mm automatic pistol, and a combat knife, and protected by a body armor vest. He had also removed the searcher's radio.
Gunn's sneaky survival plan was off to a running start. The lead man of the search team cautiously entered the tunnel, a long flashlight tucked under his armpit, lighting his path. He stepped slowly from the tunnel into the first chamber, crouched in a firing position, and pivoted his body from right to left, swinging his flashlight as he moved. All he saw was the skeleton of the old sailor, the rotting furniture, and the seal hides that hung from one wall. He relaxed, lowered his gun, and spoke into a radio set that was clamped around his head. "This is Number One. There is nobody in the tunnel and cave except the bones of an old seaman who must have been a castaway on the island. Do you read me?"
"I read you, Number One," came the voice of the helicopter pilot, accented by the roar of the engines above and behind him. "You're certain there is no sign of the Numa agents?"
"Believe me, they're not in here."
"Soon as numbers 4, 5, and 6 reach you, I'll conduct a search of the sea cliffs."
Number One switched off his radio. It was the last act of his life. Giordino sprang from behind the sealskins and rammed one of the ancient obsidian-tipped spears into the man's throat. There was a ghastly coughing, gurgling sound, and then silence, as the searcher crumpled to the floor of the chamber, dead. Giordino snatched away the assault rifle almost before the man struck the ground. Quickly, he pulled the body off to the side of the tunnel portal and removed the headset radio, placing it on his own head. Next, he wadded up his foul-weather gear into a ball and pressed it against the muzzle of the rifle.
"Number One," shouted a voice from the archway tunnel entrance. "What have you found?"
Giordino cupped his mouth with one hand and shouted toward the rear of the chamber.
"Only an old skeleton."
"Nothing else?" The second searcher seemed reluctant to enter the cave.
"Nothing."
Giordino decided to take a risk.
"Come on in and see for yourself, Number Two."
As if he were a buck sniffing the air, Number Two warily entered the chamber. Giordino switched on a flashlight with the beam aimed at the intruder's eyes and shot him once in the head between the eyes, the foul weather gear muffling the gunfire. Gunn came rushing into the chamber, assault rifle at the ready, not knowing what he would find.
"Now it's 2 against 3, Giordino triumphantly greeted him.
"Don't get cocky," Gunn warned him. "Once the helicopter returns, we're trapped in here."
"If they buy my act as Number One like Number Two did, maybe I can play P.T. Barnum again and sucker them inside."
The next batch of searchers were not nearly as guileless as the first. They approached on the road leading to the cave with the same degree of wariness as a postal inspector examining a possible letter bomb. While the helicopter hovered overhead, they advanced one by one, two covering their comrade, who dropped flat before covering them in a leapfrog tactic that moved them ever closer to the archway at the tunnel entrance. They were on their guard because Giordino stayed off the radio as much as possible and did not respond to their calls, for fear of their wising up to a strange voice. They stripped one of the bodies that closely matched Giordino's shoulder and waist size. After slipping into the black coveralls that were 2 inches longer in the sleeves and 4 inches in the pants length, he simply folded them back, slung the assault rifle over one shoulder, and boldly stepped outside. He spoke out of one corner of his mouth into the headset's microphone, trying to use the same pitch as had the man he'd killed.
"What's taking you, Number Four?" he asked, unruffled, without looking up at the helicopter. "You're acting like old women. I told you there is nothing inside the tunnel and cave but the rotting bones of a seaman who was a castaway on the island."
"You do not sound yourself, Number One."
Giordino knew he couldn't fool them any longer.
"I've got a cold coming on, not surprising in this intolerable weather."
"Your cold must have cost you 4 inches in height."
"Make jokes if you will," mumbled Giordino. "I'm getting out of the rain. I suggest you do the same."
He turned and re-entered the cave, certain he would not receive a bullet in the back, not until the searchers were positive they would not be shooting one of their own men.
"They're wise," said Gunn. "I heard your exchange over the radio."
"What's Plan 2A?" Giordino asked laconically.
"We crawl back through the roof collapse in the next tunnel and ambush them from there.
We'll be lucky to hit one or two at the most."
"At least that will put the odds in our favor," Gunn said, almost cheerfully.
They had only a few minutes, so they worked feverishly to reopen a crawl space through the rock into the tomb vault. Despite the damp cold, they were sweating heavily by the time they dragged the two dead bodies through the narrow opening and snaked in themselves, dragging their backpacks after them. Their timing was near perfect. They had no sooner propped the rocks back in place until they were looking into the outer chamber through tiny peepholes than Number 4 leaped into the chamber and dropped to the floor, as Number 5 raced in just behind, both rotating their lights and their gun muzzles in swift arcs from wall to wall.
"I told you so," Giordino whispered softly in Gunn's ear, so it would not be picked up by the microphone in front of his mouth. "They left Number 6 outside as reserve."
"There is no one in here," said Number 4. "The cave is empty."
"Impossible," came the voice of the helicopter pilot. "All three were approaching the tunnel not 15 minutes ago."
"He's right," agreed Number 5. "Numbers 1, 2, and 3 have disappeared."
They talked in undertones, but Gunn picked up every word over his headset radios. Still on their guard and alert for any movement, they nonetheless relaxed to a small degree when they saw no possible hiding place for anyone inside the chamber.
"Take the one standing," Giordino whispered softly. "They're wearing body armor, so aim for the head. I'll take the one on the ground."
Slipping their gun muzzles into holes no larger than an inch and a half in diameter, just enough to see over the front sight, they lined up on the men who had come to kill them and squeezed off two shots in unison that sounded like a thunderclap inside the rock-walled chamber. The man on the ground merely twitched, while the one standing threw up his hands, gasped, and folded wearily over the body at his feet. Giordino brushed away the rocks in front of his face, extended the flashlight through the hole, and studied their handiwork. He turned to Gunn and made a slashing gesture across his throat. Gunn understood and switched off his headset radio.
"We must remain where we are," Giordino muttered.
Before he could explain, a voice burst over the radio. "What happened in there?" No longer interested in subterfuge, Giordino replied, "No big deal, we shot a rabbit."
"Rabbit?" demanded the helicopter pilot. "What sort of nonsense is that?"
"I fear our comrades are dead," said Number 6, soberly. "Those Numa devils must have killed them."
"Those were the rabbits I was talking about," announced Giordino, adding insult to injury.
"You will surely die," said the helicopter pilot. "As the old gangsters used to say to the cops, come and get us."
"That won't be necessary," said the pilot.
"Duck down," Giordino hissed to Gunn. "Here it comes." The pilot lined up the nose of his bird with the entrance of the tunnel and fired off one of his missiles. Then came a loud whoosh as the rocket burst out of its pod attached to the fuselage of the helicopter. The rocket did not make it through the tunnel before striking against one wall and exploding. The force of the blast inside a rock-hard contained area was deafening. The concussion felt as though a grand piano had fallen on them from the 10th floor. Pulverized rock erupted in a deadly spray that sliced every object in the chamber into shreds. Smoke and dust compressed together in the small space, seethed and whirled with hurricane force, before taking the path of least resistance and funneling out the tunnel and into the atmosphere outside. Every combustible object inside the chamber immediately burst into flame. Incredibly, neither the roofs of the tunnel nor the chamber collapsed. The main force of the explosion was blown back through the tunnel along with the smoke and dust.
Giordino and Gunn felt as though huge fists had punched the air out of their lungs. Quickly reacting, they pulled the upper half of their coveralls over their faces to filter out the dust and smoke, before retreating temporarily into the inner tomb.
"I hope to God they don't send another rocket in here," Gunn said, coughing. "That will spell our end for sure."
Giordino could hardly hear him above the ringing in his ears.
"I have a hunch they'll think one was enough," he rasped between hacks.
Slowly recovering his numbed senses, he began pulling away the rocks and widening an opening.
"I'm getting damn tired of moving rock, I'll tell you."
Once through, they groped through the smoke and dust for the extra weapons from their assailants' bodies, until they had 5 assault rifles and an equal number of automatic pistols between them. Struggling to breathe in the non-existent air, and working blind, Giordino lashed 3 of the assault rifles together with cord from his backpack. The 3 guns were now wrapped parallel. Then he ran a cord around the triggers and tied it under the guards.
"The last thing they'll expect is for us to rush out the tunnel shooting," he said to Gunn.
"You take number 6. I'll try for the helicopter." Gunn wiped his soiled glasses clean on his sleeve and nodded.
"Better let me go first. You won't have a chance at firing at the helicopter if number 6 isn't eliminated."
Giordino was hesitant to let the little deputy director of NUMA take on an almost suicidal job. He was about to voice a protest when Gunn raised his weapon and disappeared into the fire and smoke. Gunn stumbled and sprawled on his chest in the tunnel, staggered to his feet, and ran forward again, fearing that bullets would cut him down the second he materialized from the residue still pouring from the tunnel entrance. But number 6 was incapable of believing anyone was still alive inside, and he had let down his guard while talking with the pilot of the helicopter. Gunn's disadvantage was that he could hardly see, and he had no idea where number 6 might be standing in relation to the archway. His glasses filmed with soot, his eyes running, he scarcely discerned a vague figure in black standing 10 yards away and to the right of the archway. He squeezed the trigger and opened fire. His bullets flew wide around number 6 without striking flesh. The searcher spun around and snapped off 5 shots at Gunn, 2 missing but 1 striking him in the calf of his left leg, the others pounding into the body armor and sending Gunn reeling backward. Then, unexpectedly, Giordino burst through the smoke with all 3 guns blazing and nearly tore the head off number 6. Without hesitation, he swung the barrels of the 3 guns skyward and opened up on the belly of the helicopter, sending nearly 3,000 rounds a minute tearing into the thin metal. Stunned at what he witnessed below, seeing 2 men in the same uniform as the searchers shooting at each other, the pilot hesitated before taking any action. By the time he set up to fire the machine mounted under the nose of the MC Explorer, Giordino was pouring a startling volume of bullets into the unarmored helicopter. As if a sewing machine were stitching a hem, the constant stream of fire moved up the side of the fuselage and sprayed through the windshield into the cockpit. Then all went silent as the rifle's ammo magazines ran empty. The Explorer seemed to hang suspended. Then it abruptly lurched, fell out of control, crashed into the side of the mountain 300 yards below the archway, and burst into flames. Giordino dropped his rifles and rushed to the side of Gunn, who was clutching his wounded leg.
"Stay where you are," Giordino ordered. "Do not move." "Merely a scratch," Gunn forced through clenched teeth. "Scratch hell, the bullet broke your tibia. You've got a compound fracture."
Gunn looked up at Giordino through the pain and managed a tight grin.
"I can't say I think a hell of a lot about your bedside manner."
Giordino didn't pay any attention to Gunn's heroics. He pulled out a lace from his shoe and made a temporary tourniquet around the thigh above the knee.
"Can you hold that for a minute?"
"I guess I'd better if I don't want to bleed to death," Gunn groaned.
Giordino ran back into the tunnel, through the smoldering chamber, and from behind the cave-in retrieved his backpack, which contained a first-aid kit. He was back in a few minutes and worked swiftly, proficiently, disinfecting the wound and doing his best to stem the flow of blood. "I'm not even going to think about setting it," said Giordino. "Better to let a doctor do it in Cape Town." He didn't want to move the little man, so he made him as comfortable as possible and covered him from the drizzle with a plastic sheet out of his backpack. His next chore was to call the Admiral, report on Gunn's wound, and beg for a quick rescue. When he finished his conversation with Sandecker, he put the phone in his pocket and stared at the burning helicopter on the mountain slope below. "Insanity," he said softly to himself. "Pure, unadulterated insanity. What cause can possibly motivate so many men to kill and be killed?" He could only hope the answers would come sooner rather than later.